By the beginning of 1916, the First World War had become something very different from what most leaders, soldiers, and civilians had imagined in the summer of 1914. The old expectations of movement, decisive battles, and swift victory had collapsed into mud, wire, artillery, disease, exhaustion, and burial lists that grew longer with every passing month. The Western Front, which many had expected to be the stage of a dramatic breakthrough, had hardened into a continuous scar across Europe. From the North Sea to the Swiss frontier, millions of men faced one another across trenches, dugouts, machine gun nests, shell craters, and blasted villages that seemed to belong more to a nightmare than to the civilized continent that had entered the war with flags, speeches, and confidence. The year 1916 did not begin with innocence. It began with experience. The armies had already learned that courage alone could not carry men across open ground swept by machine guns and artillery. They had learned that cavalry charges belonged more to memory than to modern battle. They had learned that barbed wire could stop entire battalions, that shells could destroy landscapes, and that the human body was terribly fragile in the face of industrial warfare. Yet they had not learned how to end the war. That was the central tragedy of 1916. The leaders of Europe understood that the conflict had become immense, costly, and nearly impossible to control, but they still believed victory could be forced if enough pressure was applied for long enough. This was the logic of attrition. Attrition was not simply fighting hard. It was not merely suffering heavy casualties. It was a strategy based on wearing down the enemy until he could no longer continue. Instead of seeking one brilliant maneuver that would shatter the opposing army in a single campaign, commanders increasingly accepted that the war might be won through exhaustion. The enemy's soldiers had to be killed, wounded, captured, demoralized, or drained faster than they could be replaced. His artillery had to be silenced, his supplies consumed, his officers overworked, his civilians made hungry, and his government forced to doubt whether the struggle remained sustainable. In such a war, victory was no longer imagined only as a flag planted in an enemy capital. It could also mean breaking the enemy's capacity to resist. This idea was not entirely new. Armies throughout history had tried to wear down opponents through blockade, siege, and prolonged campaigning. However, the First World War gave attrition a modern and terrible scale. Industrial states could mobilize millions of men, produce shells by the millions, move supplies by rail, borrow vast sums of money, control newspapers, ration food, and organize entire societies around the needs of the front. This meant that armies could survive losses that would have destroyed earlier forces. It also meant that commanders could keep feeding men and material into battles of staggering duration. The war did not stop because a battle was costly. In many cases, the cost became part of the calculation. By 1916, both sides faced a grim question: if maneuver had failed, how could victory be achieved? Germany, France, Britain, Russia, Austria-Hungary, Italy, and the Ottoman Empire all confronted versions of the same problem. They were fighting a war larger than their original plans, longer than their political promises, and more demanding than their economies had been prepared to sustain. Every government had to ask how much blood its society could endure. Every general staff had to ask whether the enemy was weaker than he appeared. Every soldier at the front had to ask whether the next attack had any meaning beyond adding more names to the dead. The Western Front shaped the logic of attrition more than any other theater. After the German advance through Belgium and northern France had been stopped in 1914, both sides tried to outflank each other in what became known as the race to the sea. Instead of producing open movement, the race produced a long line of trenches. By 1915, repeated offenses had failed to restore mobility. The French attacked in Artois and Champagne,